Today, the upside of property investing. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian and international flavour. And today I'm joined again by Anthony Davis. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Martin. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you very much for coming and spending a bit more time with us. Your last post was well received, but there were some really, really interesting comments in the YouTube channel as well. So I guess it might be a good place to start to pick up some of those comments and just explore them a bit further. But then perhaps touch on a couple of other issues too, because there's quite a lot going on.
Absolutely. Well, as you know, I'm a pretty thick-skinned guy, so all comments are welcome. And I take them all very constructively and none of them personally. So all comments very welcome.
So. I think that's good. And it's worth saying that part of what DFA is trying to do here is not just propagate like an echo chamber a single point of view, right? What I'm trying to do is to get a synthesis of different views and different opinions and to have a bit of a discussion, a bit of a debate going, because there will be people who say, look, you know, clearly, you're a very experienced property investor. You've done really, really well, but, you know, doesn't necessarily represent the ordinary person. On the other hand, I think there'll be a lot of people who are saying, well, actually, you know, property investment is a big deal, and we can learn quite a lot from somebody who's been through the process for a number of years. So, you know, to my mind, it's all good in terms of that debate and that conversation. And I'm glad you've got a thick skin. One of the things I learned early on DFA was a thick skin is quite important, right? So one of the things that came up quite a few times was, well, you know, you've got this massive portfolio, so you must be, you know, super rich and have super expertise. What's your reaction to that then?
My reaction is not much expertise required. I have a lot of debt. As a matter of fact, John Adams on one of your shows recently said, I think just last week, said that if he had $900,000 worth of debt, he'd be awake at night every night. I have a lot more debt than that, over four times that actually. But right. I think it's good debt, and I think if it's debt that is being serviced by a strategy, like it's like having business debt. If it's serviced by the business and your business is healthy, then you're okay. And to your point before, I think you know you should have two sides to the coin when it comes to the state of the housing market. I think the housing market generally is a good way to accumulate wealth. I know there's a lot of risks in it now and fragility in the banking system, but and you know, like myself, you know, there's potential for significant downside. I experienced it directly, but I think you know generally the best wealth creation over the many decades has been property ownership. And if you look at what Margaret Thatcher did back in the 70s, she came out with a scheme to exactly do this. It was called Right to Buy, and it was enabling people to buy local authority houses, council houses. And that did a very positive thing in the community because it made a lot of homeowners that would never have been able to be homeowners. And one of the comments to answer your question you just made, one of the comments that was made was, you know, how on earth did you manage to buy a house at 19 years old? Well, actually, it was a local authority property that I bought. It was basically a council house that I was living in. And that's how I got onto the property ladder, you know, so young. I think that if you could find an opportunity like that young, you can get onto the property ladder, you know, and start building, you know, equity as soon as you are able. So, but yeah, I think definitely the property market has two sides to it. And I think that there definitely needs to be a side of positivity. I think there's a lot of upside in certain markets. I think even yesterday, Martin, you pointed out an article that said the Brisbane housing market was potentially likely to go up 20%. I don't necessarily agree with that statement, by the way. I hope it does. But I do think that there's certain positivity in the housing markets like Brisbane, as there's certain negativity as well.
Yeah, and I guess the key point is that you could argue that the last 20 to 30 years has been atypical if you look at home prices growth around the world, right? And that was partly to do with deregulation of the financial system. As you say, policies that were designed to encourage people to buy property, and particularly, you know, in the UK, in the US, and indeed elsewhere as well. And I guess the question for people coming into the market at this time, when property prices relative to income are way, way higher than they were then, is, you know, is it likely that we're going to have the same 20 to 30 year run? And I, my own personal view is no, I think it's highly unlikely that we're going to see it, because I think there were some atypical things. And if you go over the long term, certainly in Australia, home prices, you know, didn't actually move up for a lot of the last 140, 150 years. There were a couple of peaks and troughs. But, you know, it'll be it's really a bit more complex now, I think, because of where we start from, right, as to whether you could do the same thing. But having said that, if you look at long-term returns over a 20 or 30 year period, you know, over that last 20 or 30 years, and you compare shares with property, net-net, probably property has done slightly better, although it depends a little bit on precisely what you include in the costs. You know, do you include all the maintenance costs on property and those sorts of things? And if you add some of those back in as well, then possibly property becomes a little less attractive relative to shares. But it's an interesting conundrum about, you know, investment and strategies and growth strategies starting now rather than starting 30 years ago.
I think it also depends on inflation rates. There's a very interesting website that I've been looking at for a very long time called Shadowstats, shadowstats.com. And they show how inflation was previously, or the CPI was previously calculated versus how it's calculated now. Mm. And the real inflation rates are a lot higher than the government stated inflation rates.
Oh, yes.
And if the inflation rates are extremely high, what inflation does is, was first of all, erode your debt that you have over time. And of course, that has an immediate effect on the gain of things like property. And so I think that not only are you necessarily predicting how the housing market will necessarily go in certain areas, but you're also predicting what's going to happen to the currency. My feeling is that the international banking system relies on an inflation rate that's a lot higher than the government stated inflation rate. And that can be proven all over the place. You know, nowhere near as bad, of course, as countries like Venezuela. But if you think about how much things start to cost, you know, in just general society over the years, I think even in Australia, you've seen a significant increase on things like food and petrol and other just basic things that families need to purchase. So it's really an analysis, not just of property, but the general inflation and what's going on with the currency.
Yeah, well, I think you're making, you know, a really good point there. And I've done a couple of posts on the deficiencies in the current approach to the CPI calculations, which are horribly understating reality for many households. Certainly, it comes through in the household surveys. And the other point, of course, is that the employment data is also stuffed as well, insofar that there's a very narrow definition of being unemployed relative to underemployment. And in fact, I look at underemployment rather than than unemployment. And in a way, the statistics are flattering quite a lot of what's really going on. But, you know, the reality from the survey, certainly in Australia, is we've got very high inflation relative to incomes. And we've also got much more underemployment, which is a very much a dampener on income growth. And you put those two factors together, and that's one of the reasons why I continue to see confidence in Australia relatively weak, and weaker than the official, you know, reports and narrative would want us to believe. And by the way, I did a post the other day on the Gini coefficient, which is effectively looking at the distribution of wealth and income over the population base, and it looks as though Australia's distribution, inequality distribution, is higher relative to a lot of European countries, not quite as high as in the US. But again, it's another of these quite interesting statistics that you can interpret as one way to say everyone is, on average, much more wealthy than they ever were. But then, of course, averages mask critical differences. So once again, it's important to get into the detail to understand what's really going on. And I do think, I have to say, that a lot of the official statistics are designed specifically to propagate a particular view, but it isn't necessarily a reality for many people.
That's right. To your point about stocks versus shares over the last sort of 20 years, stocks and shares versus property over the last 20 years. Mm. One of the things, because that comes up a lot in general conversations I have, as you would imagine.
Yeah.
But one of the things I'll point out about that is that you get a lot of tax benefits for owning investment properties. That is also not taken into account in the calculation. Yeah. The other thing that's not taken into account in the calculation is the ability to do huge leverage. You know, you can put $70,000 in, for example, and buy a $350,000 property. That property goes up in one of my scenarios, it goes up to $750,000, $800,000. You've made $400,000 of capital gain in 12, 15 years. And then what you can do is you can go back to the bank and you can refinance that, and you can take that money out tax-free. And you can't do that with stocks and shares. You know, so you can really time, you know, when you get taxed and how you do things. And then, you know, going back to what I said on the previous video, you can add value to the property too. You can improve it and expand it, you know, redevelop the land, etc. You can't do those things to stocks and shares either. So I think property investment gives you much more flexibility than stocks and shares. And I can give many examples just from my own portfolio where I've significantly outperformed just with average properties, some big name stocks like Apple, for example, that's done extremely well over the last 15 years. And I've got average properties that have done better than if I'd have put my raw capital into the Apple stock, for example.
No, I think you make a good point. And of course, property is tangible, right? So one of the things that I keep seeing in my surveys is that people know that when they got a property, they can feel it, touch it and go around and look at it, right? Can't do that with shares or bonds or indeed even Bitcoin, right? It's all very sort of, you know, out there somewhere. And many people actually value the tangibility of property. And I think, there are trade-offs between all different asset classes and people will make different investment decisions. But as you say, there is a significant tax breaks and tax advantages to property investment. The other point in Australia, quite a few property investors here have multiple properties and they're cross-leveraged off each other. So, you know, they create equity in one and then they use the equity for the second and the third and the fourth. There are quite a few property investors in Australia who have 6, 7, 8, 9 properties. Now, that all works if the market continues to go up or is relatively stable. The difficulty, of course, is if the adverse happens and effectively prices start falling significantly, because then you get a cascading failure of values and suddenly equity is destroyed. And that's the, if you like, the trap that I'm seeing from some property investors who are now being forced to sell here because prices have dropped in some places 20, 30%. And so they're suddenly realizing that they cannot necessarily do what they want to do, which is to continue that sort of momentum. So it varies and, you know, who knows what's going to happen ahead. So I guess people need to go into this with their eyes open.
Absolutely. And I think another thing to take into account is that people need a place to store their wealth for their retirement or for later on in life. And there's not many places where you can actually do that. You can obviously put your money into some type of superannuation scheme, or we over here have a 401k scheme, a similar thing like a pension or retirement system. But all of that is pegged to the stock market. So if there's a challenge on the stock market, you know, in the last recession in 2008, there were people in the US that lost over 50% of their 401k retirement. Now, if they would have had their money in property, even some of the worst places in America didn't go down that much. So you could think to yourself, well, you know, what's more risky? And the other thing I tend to think myself, you know, I've worked for many companies that have employee stock option programs and those sorts of things. As a matter of fact, I did very well in some of the employee stock option programs that in some of the companies I work for. But, you know, when you see it from the inside, you can see when CEOs and CFOs and those sorts of folks are selling their stock and they're insider trading the market, and they have much more knowledge about what's going to happen with that stock than the general public. And so I generally feel that the stock market is an unfair playing field if you were just a general investor. And so therefore, I think it's stacked against you. So again, where do you put your wealth? You put it in stocks where it's an unfair playing field in the favor of very wealthy people who have insider knowledge. Do you put it in property where I think there's some definite advantages, as I've mentioned, or do you buy gold bars and put them under the mattress? You know, what do you do? You know, there are not many options.
You're right about that. And in fact, you know, one of the questions I keep getting asked, and I don't answer directly because it's not financial advice and I can't give financial advice, but, you know, what is the best option in terms? And I go back to, well, it depends partly what you're trying to achieve, right? If you're trying to achieve absolute security, then you might go one route. But if you're trying to achieve some balanced degree of growth and security, you might go a different route. Or if you want to be speculative, you might go a different route again. So it partly depends on your objectives. But the point I keep making is there is no 100% safe option in terms of actually wealth generation, nor indeed, wealth storage. Even deposits in a bank, you know, there are risks attached to putting your cash in the bank as well. So that's one of the things that I think people probably have beginning to wake up to now, but until quite recently, the risks were always underplayed and understated. And by the way, a lot of financial advisors in Australia, I think, have done a very poor job of truly explaining the different risks of different types of investment strategies to people, and are often, people are allured into promise of very high returns without fully understanding the potential risks attached to them.
Absolutely. And I think going back to your point about deposits not being safe, and you've talked on your program, of course, about bail-ins and things like that, which, by the way, have scared the hell out of me. Mm. If you have your money in the bank, even if it's in a deposit, and even if you think you're getting a great interest rate, like 2%, which people consider to be fantastic, if inflation is 6%, if real inflation is 6% and you're getting 2%, you're losing 4%. And 4% is significant. Yeah. So, instead of losing 4%, you need to put it in a place where you're gaining 4% over the market. And that goes to where do you then put it to keep ahead of inflation? If inflation is 6%, you need to be somewhere where you're getting 8, 10, 12% returns. And that's extremely difficult to do, even on a very good stock portfolio.
Yeah, no, I agree. Getting superior returns is really tough. Now, just going back to the 401k thing, there's some quite interesting data, I think, about the fact that many people in the US have insufficient savings for retirement, right? It's one of the big themes that seems to be coming through.
It is, absolutely. So the 401k program in the US, first of all, 401k is a tax code where they enabled you to be able to take pre-tax money and put it in a portfolio account for later and to be extracted after you're 65 tax-free. But so it's kind of a tax avoidance strategy for retirement saving. But unlike your superannuation program, first of all, with 401k, you can borrow against your 401k account. So you can take loans against your 401k account. And as long as you don't default on the loan and you pay back the loan per the loan schedule, you don't get taxed on the money you withdraw. It's a little bit like taking equity from an investment property out as a loan. If you pay that back, it's tax-free, that's fine. But what people are doing, of course, is they're taking massive loans against their 401k portfolio, and then they're either not paying the loans back on time, or they're just deferring the payments all the time. So they maintain this huge loan balance, which represents the same amount of value as the 401k. So there's no retirement savings at all. And then the other thing folks are doing, of which I do myself, by the way, is that if you are forced into a retirement program by your employer because they'll match what you put in, for example, so you'd be mad to not take them up on that. Every time you change jobs, most likely the 401k program of the next job that you take is a different program to the one you had before. And so you have a event where you can extract all of your 401k if you want. And so I personally, because my retirement strategy is obviously in property and not in that, but so I take the advantage and pull that money out, and I pay tax on it, by the way, and no problem at all. But what people are doing here in America, all over the place, is they're taking that retirement money out when they change jobs, and they're having a holiday, and they're buying a new car, and they're doing all this stuff, and they've got no retirement savings. So, kudos to the superannuation program in Australia. One thing it does force people to do is save for retirement, and there's not too many ways of getting your hands on the money before you retire. Here in America, there are literally hundreds of millions of people about to retire who have got massive loans against their 401k, or they've extracted it all like I have. So they're coming to retirement with the only thing paying them any type of salary, which is Social Security, which is like your basic pension in Australia. And that's going to leave. And by the way, not a lot of Americans have millions of dollars in equity in their house either. So unlike people who live in Sydney and Brisbane or Melbourne, where they have over time they've just accumulated by accident this massive amount of equity that they could probably pull out if they sold the house and moved somewhere much less expensive. Here in America, most retirees' house value is probably $150,000-$200,000. So they don't even have that either. They don't have that huge property equity to draw on. So no retirement portfolio, and no home equity. So we're in a in a situation where we're going to have a major problem. And then one thing where I'm very bearish about the stock market is that, you know, the 401k programs that are in place that people have been saving those are going to be extracted soon. You know, we have these baby boomers are retiring, you know, hitting, I think, something like 65 or 67 this year, something like that. I can't remember exactly what the age is, but so they are starting to retire. They're starting to pull out their 401k. Well, the 401k is invested in stocks and shares. So what do you think is going to happen to the stock market when 100 million people retire over the next 20 or 30 years? I don't think it's going to be anywhere near as healthy as it is now. And no. So don't be in the stock market would be my tip, you know, on that one. And in the US anyway.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there's been a very significant number of people who, as you say, in Australia are sitting on quite a large amounts of equity in their properties. And we've got more than a million people now who are in that sort of 55 to 75 year bracket, right? And yep. Quite a few of them now are wanting to start to access some of the equity in their properties. And so now what they're doing is essentially saying, wow, okay, well, so it looks as though property prices might actually be off the floor a little bit. So maybe now's a really good time to think about pulling that equity out, downsizing, and essentially going somewhere smaller so that I can actually then use the equity to be able to actually fund my retirement. That is quite an interesting challenge because there are many more people now who are in that situation wanting to sell than those who are actually wanting to buy. And so I argue that, as you've made the point, you know, a lot of them also have stocks and shares, which they may well want to shed as well. But the fact that the oversupply of property coming onto the market over the next 5 to 8 years, because of the baby boomer bulge, is actually going to be very significant. And in fact, I did a post with Joe Wilkes on this some time back, basically making the point that people have understated and misunderstood the implication of this huge population bulge, right, of people sitting on quite high levels of assets, but now wanting to convert those assets essentially into income to be able to actually move into, you know, the retirement phase. And it's interesting, in Australia, there's a big review happening at the moment on the whole question of the retirement strategies and programs. And, you know, do things need to change to be able to actually take that differently into the future? Because essentially, we're going to have the same issue here. A lot of people may suddenly realize that what they thought they had isn't actually what they're going to have, and then that puts more pressure back on the government to be able to provide some level of support for a greater proportion of the population than they ever thought they would. And there's a smaller working population than previously. So these are huge demographic shifts that I think many people have yet to fully understand.
I agree with that. I think the positive spin I would put on that is, of course, these properties that have been in owned by these families, the older generation, for a very long time. Some of them are coming onto the market now. I've seen recently, you know, been in the family for 130 years. The location of those properties, by the way, is absolutely fabulous. You know, these were the original houses in Sydney and some of these larger cities in Australia, and absolutely blue chip perfect areas. You know, all I can say is, if you can get hold of one of those, you and put a block of units on it, you'll make a fortune. That's the positive spin on it.
No, I agree. And by the way, you know, my theory is that it's those types of properties, either because, you know, there's a limited supply and they're probably on large blocks and closer into the city relative to a lot of others. They're the ones who are going to do better relative to the urban fringe, where I still think we've got too much new stuff being built and a lot of people in financial difficulty. And of course, as we discussed in our last post, the high rise, forget the high rise, you know, there's more bad news come out in terms of yet more buildings looking as though they've got issues on them. So what it shows you is that you have to actually go granular and really understand the market, you know, down to quite a little low level. But there's one other interesting question I wanted to discuss with you today was Queensland, because I understand that there are some changes coming up in Queensland which could have quite a significant impact in that market.
Yeah, there's been some land tax changes that came into effect in the new financial year, so beginning of July, that I wasn't aware of until I spoke to my own accountant over there, and he'd mentioned that these land tax changes were going to potentially be devastating to some and actually quite positive to others. So I'll give you a bit of history. So Queensland applies land tax, or did apply does apply land tax to what they call absentees, right? So people who don't live in Australia, but have properties on land, like houses, in Queensland, and they would basically charge you a significant amount of land tax based on the value of the land itself, over and above a minimal amount, and of course they would expect to be paid that land tax immediately too. There was no way of deferring the payment. In my case, it was my land tax bills were over $10,000 a year, at least $10,000, maybe over $12,000 actually. So what was a little bit frustrating to a lot of us was this absentee surcharge, which triggers this land tax bill, was being forced upon even Australian citizens, and Queensland was the only state doing that. Other states in Australia didn't enforce land tax on Australian citizens that were living overseas. Queensland was. Thankfully, though, this change, they are no longer. So they are falling in line with the rest of Australia. And I think actually something that had to do with this, I think, was the election results. Queensland got decimated. The Labour Party that's still in power in Queensland at the state level got absolutely decimated. And because of some of these unique rulings that they'd put in over the years, and this being one of. But the other thing that they did to land tax was they increased it. And because non-Australian citizens or foreign-owned companies have to pay land tax, these companies that have foreign ownership now are paying huge amounts of land tax to the state government. And these companies have loads of land. One example is Bundaberg Sugar, which is owned by, I believe, a Belgian company or some European company anyway, is now getting these enormous bills from the state of Queensland. Adani, I believe that a lot of their land, because they're foreign-owned, of course, they have a lot of land in North Queensland that they've opened up for the mine and everything that's going on up there. And of course, they are kicking up about this this land tax change. So one of the things from a property perspective is there was a lot of very disgruntled owners of property, and I mean a lot of us that don't live over there, but have properties over there, and what I think, and certainly my perspective is now I'm very open to buying more property in Queensland now with this change, as I'm sure many others, I'm not saying this will have a huge effect on the property pricing in Brisbane or in Queensland generally, but it will have some. I was certainly not investing any more money in Queensland because of this unique situation in Queensland, and I was certainly looking at other states to invest. I think that Queensland is an attractive place to invest, Southeast Queensland particularly, and is very attractive to people who Australian citizens who don't live there. They do want to keep their property. And the main reason from my personal situation, I have quite a large house in Spring Hill in Brisbane, and the only reason why I'm keen to keep that is because that's our family house. My kids were born in that house. I've got a lot of nostalgia associated with that house, and it's in a pretty nice area, and it's a very good rental property, and I don't want to be forced to sell it because of this Queensland government, taking advantage of a situation that I have no control over. And so I think these land tax changes in Queensland are appropriate. It brings the state into line with the other states in Australia. But I do think that there's a lot of foreign-owned businesses that are now going to try and lobby the government to make a change or do something to make them whole.
Very interesting. And of course, BIS Oxford Economics is right, then 20% rise in prices over 3 years in Brisbane might be a good time, but on
it
the other
be.
Hand
maybe that's the reason. I doubt it, but maybe
I have to say I'm a little bit more skeptical than they are, but we'll see. No, that's very interesting. So I appreciate your time today, Anthony. I think that's been quite a wide-ranging discussion, and I actually think that's good. So we'll perhaps pick up the conversation again a little bit down the track. I think one of the things that I would like to explore further with you is the real estate market in the US, and of course you are actually a lapsed but qualified real estate businessman, right?
I am, yeah. I have a Texas, although it's expired and I need to renew it, and they force us to take all these very complex legal exams in order for the real estate license to renew. But I have a real estate license in the state of Texas. And the only reason why I got it was because I wanted to learn a bit more about the industry itself, how things are done here in the US, because they're very different to other countries. And then I think we talked about potentially the home loan and mortgage system, and talking a bit more about that on a subsequent video. We have a very interesting setup over here with entities involved called things like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and Sally Mae, who does student loans, by the way. So they all have these really interesting names. But they are critical to the mortgage issuance system here in America. They are the reason why we are able to have these 30-year fixed rate loans. I'll go into more detail on that if you like. These are government-sponsored enterprises, so they're part government and part private shareholder-owned businesses. Most of them nearly went bankrupt by a very they kept alive by a very small amount even after the government bailed them out in the last recession, and I could go into why they are very fragile in their structure. They were set up in the 30s and after the Great Depression. So they were only really tested to an extent in the last recession. In their stability, and we saw that they weren't actually very stable or are not very stable. So I could talk about that in more detail. You might find that interesting.
Yeah, no, I think that would be a really, really good conversation to have, because many people over here wouldn't fully understand the dynamics of the US market, and it's, you know, a huge market, and clearly has an influence on property around the world. So let's sort of slate that for our next discussion, and I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Martin. Appreciate yours.
See you later. Bye-bye. So there you have it. A very interesting conversation from Anthony. And I hope to pick up the conversation about the US market in our next conversation. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching. And I'll see you again next time.